Hi, this is Philip Anthony Albertelli, and welcome once again to The Week in Doubt, a podcast for atheists, agnostics, and whoever. And this is episode 22, Defining Atheism. Before I get started with the main topic of this episode, I'll take a moment to cover some short news stories. There was one I found on HuffPost Science back on the 20th of this month that caught my interest. It's entitled Altruism, Brain Region Called Temporoparietal Junction Linked in University of Zurich Study. And what caught my attention about this article was that I had not too long ago, I had done an episode of the podcast that was dedicated to the topic of atheism and morality. And I talked about how I personally believe that, at least in part, morality is something that's hardwired in us through evolution, in that you don't necessarily need to believe in religion to be a moral being. And sometimes religious people will pose the kind of juvenile question to atheists, well, if there's no God, what's to keep you from raping, killing, or doing whatever you want? And a good retort, this isn't me, this has been said by many others, I think Penn Jillette, Richard Dawkins, and they say to the person, do you really mean to tell me that the only thing keeping you from killing or raping or committing atrocities is your religion or your belief in God and fear of being punished by that God in the afterlife? Or, I'm paraphrasing, but you get my gist. And I think when I was younger, maybe I would have bought into that question too, that if there's no God, everything is nihilism, anything goes, there is no morality. But I think even though we're, you could argue that we're also wired to be tribal and cruel, even predatory at times, I think we are also wired for morality. We're social creatures. We can be altruistic. We're capable of empathy and compassion. And I think, sure, part of our moral sensibilities, part of our moral code is probably man-made, is cultural, is societal. But I think a lot of it probably is rooted in evolution as well. And during that episode of the podcast, I'd gone fairly in-depth about how we can see what scientists would call proto-ethics or proto-morality, even in the animal kingdom, even though, in fairness, there's also many examples of extreme cruelty and indifference in the animal kingdom as well. But I think it's true, anyone who is only being good because they're afraid of being punished by God or because of their belief by God, that's kind of scary. And I think even the religious people pose that question are probably better people than that. Even if they didn't have their religion, I at least hope they'd still care for the children. If they saw an old lady drop her purse in the street, they'd pick it up and give it to her. If they saw a friend crying, they'd try to console them. If they saw an animal whimpering, they'd try to help it. But I think this story goes to my theory, and not like I found it. There's been many much smarter people who, in a much more scientific way, have expounded the belief that morality, at least in part, is rooted in genetics and evolution. But I think stories like this really help to back up that idea or theory. So the article begins, "Some people are generous, others not so much. Why is that? A new study from Switzerland suggests that the answer to that question may be a matter of neuroanatomy, with the brains of altruistic types having more gray matter in a region of the brain known as the temporoparietal junction. It's the first study to show a clear link between brain structure and altruism, according to a written statement released by the University of Zurich. And I think this also kind of backs up the idea that I've talked about, that basically we are our brains. And that doesn't bother me, because I guess I've had time to get acclimated to the idea. But I think it does bother a lot of religious people. People want to believe that we're more than the sum of our parts, which I think you could probably still argue, but they want to believe that there's an eternal soul and indestructible energy or life essence within us. They want to believe in something more poetic than we are our brains, and when they go, we go. And there was a time when even I found that a very disturbing and unpleasant thought, which goes back to, I've talked many times on the show about how I didn't just wake up one morning and say, hey, I feel like not believing in God. It was a process. My faith eroded with time, starting back in fairly early childhood. And it's funny, I was watching some clips on YouTube of this guy I'd never heard of before, this philosopher, Robert Anton Wilson, I think his name was. And I'm surprised I've never heard of him before. He's this really cool, interesting guy. I guess he passed away not that long ago, several years ago. I think he was in his early 70s, perhaps. But I was watching some old talks he had given and listening to some old interviews. And I don't think I'd call him an atheist, even though he talks about basically having lost his faith in his own strain of Christianity. I can't recall what right now. I think he was Irish American. Was it Catholicism? I can't remember. It might not have been Catholicism. But he talks about losing faith in Christianity as a child, and it reminded me a lot of me, and it made me feel good, because sometimes I feel like when I tell people about the origins of losing my faith, it kind of sounds a little overly simplistic or silly. When I talk about how it probably started when I realized there wasn't a Santa, there wasn't an Easter Bunny, and I noticed that people seem to talk in similar fashion about God as they do about those mythological holiday figures. And he basically had the same story. Talked about how when he was a young boy, first he found out the Easter Bunny was fake, then Santa, vice versa. And he was just waiting for them to next tell him that God was fake too, but they never admitted it. And like I said, I wouldn't call him an atheist. I think he referred to himself as a connoisseur of religions. And he even had a fascination with Aleister Crowley. Any of you who are metalheads, as I am in part, might remember the old Aussie song, Mr. Crowley, which was actually about the infamous British occultist Aleister Crowley. And Crowley had this whole kind of occult system of transformational magic. Whether he really believed that you were summoning, you know, literally summoning demons with fangs and horns and wings, I don't know, or if it was more all about consciousness and transforming consciousness. I'm not sure how much of it Crowley himself took literally, how much of it was figurative and symbolic. But I think Wilson admired him as someone who's kind of a pioneer in transforming consciousness. And he believed that even if there really wasn't something supernatural going on, that these kind of systems that Crowley created or practiced were capable of transforming consciousness. So he really seemed like he was big into consciousness, transforming consciousness, about the relativism of reality. And he talked about how everyone has their own reality tunnel. You know, everyone views the world through their own eyes, and that's their reality. but he's a pretty wild guy. So if you want to learn anything about him, you might want to stop by YouTube and look for Robert Anton Wilson. The only reason why I'm mentioning him is because, it kind of warmed my heart a little and gave me a sense of consolation that I found this other person who's much older than I am, but who was talking about their childhood and how they had had such a similar awakening story to my own. But back on track. So I was talking about that story about the temporal parietal junction and altruism, and how it kind of reminded me not only how I think we're wired to some degree to be moral beings, but also, in a sense, we are our brains, as unpleasant as that might seem to some. And I've often talked about one of the reasons why I doubt an afterlife is just using my own common sense to draw a conclusion from what I know about modern neuroscience and anatomy. We know that the brain is indeed a complex organ, and that it's compartmentalized, and that different areas of the brain are experienced for different areas of emotion, cognition, impulse control. And we know if the brain gets damaged due to injury or due to a degenerative illness like Alzheimer's, that our personality and our ability to interact with the world is directly affected. So it seems like a logical conclusion that the brain, in a sense, generates or is responsible for consciousness. So most likely when the brain goes, so does the individual self. I mean, I could grasp at straws. I like to play devil's advocate against myself. So you might be able to say that, well, maybe the brain is a temporary vessel for some kind of indestructible eternal self, some kind of soul or eternal consciousness, and that it just kind of resides in the fleshy brain. It needs to operate like a temporary, uses the brain like some kind of temporary vessel. But that's a whole lot of speculation, and you can't really prove that scientifically. And that's just an idea. That's me grasping at straws. But there are people, like I've talked about Stuart Hameroff on the show before, who is an anesthesiologist who believes that consciousness resides in these structures in brain cells called microtubules. And that might help explain how maybe consciousness is able to survive death. I think it's worth looking into. I think scientists should look into it. And who knows, maybe someday we'll get a pleasant surprise and learn that the individual self really is able to survive death. But I'm not holding my breath on that one. So I did find a similar story while I was trying to track this story down again, because I had bookmarked it, but then somehow I lost track. Okay, here we go. This story is from April 27th, 2012. So it's not all that long ago. And I think this was from the Huffington Post now in their science section, I believe. Or actually, it might have been from HuffPost Religion. I'm looking at it right now. It's an article by Greg Miller, and it's entitled "Religion and Brain: Belief Decreases with Analytical Thinking, Study Shows." I could have told you that from personal experience. But this article starts out, "Many people with religious convictions feel that their faith is rock solid. But a new study finds that prompting people to engage in analytical thinking can cause their religious beliefs to waver, if only a little. Researchers say the findings have potentially significant implications for understanding the cognitive underpinnings of religion." Like I said, I mean, yeah, I could have told you that from personal experience. And it goes back to what I was just talking about. It's not like I woke up one day as an adult and said, wouldn't it be kind of fashionable or chic to not believe in God and, have everyone look funny at me when I tell them I'm an atheist? It's, as I said, it started from an early age. I think, everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I know I have a lot of weaknesses. One of my strengths, perhaps, is that I'm heavily inclined towards analytical thinking. And I think it was this tendency or propensity that started me from an early age into questioning the validity of the supernatural religious claims that had been kind of drilled into me growing up. And like I said, it was that same kind of analytical thinking where you say, okay, Easter Bunny, he's not real, check. Santa, not real, check. Why do people sound like they're kind of making things up as they go or flying by the seat of their pants when they're talking about God? Well, maybe in a sense, he's similar to Santa and the Easter Bunny. You know, you're using analytical thinking to draw what I think are logical conclusions. And then it wasn't just that. You know, obviously, I went on, like I talk about a lot, I have a love of ancient history, a love of philosophy, even a love of religion. But when you see how religions are man-made, how they evolve out of other belief systems, how there's some kind of cultural cross-pollination that goes on, sharing and swapping of ideas, and when you see how religious texts contradict one another, not just on the outside, meaning, you know, different religions have different claims, obviously. Buddhism makes different claims than Catholicism, etc. But even within a religion, say, a lot of times I've talked about the contradictions and internally, say, like the contradictions between the Gospels. When you start to see the man-made nature of religion, and then when you start to look at things like I mentioned a little bit ago, how consciousness seems to be an emergent property of the brain, the physical brain, which we know, unfortunately, is temporary, then consciousness, too, might be temporary. So it was that type of thinking that led me to doubt the existence of a creator, although I always have to offer the caveat that I don't know for sure. You know, you can't prove 100% that there's not a God. But even if there is, who the heck is he, she, or it? What's its nature? Most likely, if there is some kind of creator, it's probably not identical with any of our man-made concepts of God that we find in our man-made texts. Let's see, before I go too far down that path, were there any other news stories? Well, the Chick-fil-A story is huge in the news. I think that story has been kicking around for at least a week now. And if you haven't heard, but you probably have, the president of the fast food chain Chick-fil-A came out and just kind of boldly admitted his conservative religious stance on marriage, that he thinks marriage should be defined traditionally as something between a man and a woman, and he doesn't approve of gay marriage, and that caused a huge backlash. And now even here I am in the greater Boston area, and our mayor here, Mayor Menino, who sometimes affectionately or not so affectionately referred to as Mumbles, has basically said to Chick-fil-A, not so welcome in the Boston area, or in Boston at least. So what do I think about all this? I've mentioned a few times on the show how I'm pro-gay rights. The idea of gay marriage doesn't bother me. If two people of the same sex love each other, they want to get together, why the heck not? Now, I have kind of in a way, I have a cynical view of marriage where I think people think that marriage has always existed in the modern sense where two people fall in love, they choose to get married, when for most of history, marriage has been about dowries and politics and power and powerful families marrying into one another, and that for most of history, marriages have been arranged. And for all those people who talk about how they believe in the biblical definition of marriage, well, there's a whole lot of prophets and patriarchs, kings in the Bible who were polygamist. So how exactly do we define marriage in the quote-unquote biblical sense? So I definitely, well, I'll say my views on gay marriage are diametrically opposed to the Chick-fil-A guys. Do I think that people should keep him from opening stores? Well, let's say the Boston mayor, Menino, what he did basically kind of pulling back the red carpet, you know, on Chick-fil-A. I won't lose any sleep about it at night. Do I think it was necessary that he said you're not welcome here? I don't know. I think people should be allowed the freedom of speech. If anything, I would say maybe you could argue in a sense that, hey, at least the guy was principled in a sense, even though it might damage his business, he still came out and said to the world what he sincerely thinks. On the other hand, you might say it was a really kind of dumb business move, 'cause in this day and age, I mean, whether you want to argue how secular our society is or not, people are definitely becoming more and more accepting of gay people and the idea of gay marriage even. So even though there's still a lot of conservatives out there, might not have been the smartest move for the president of Chick-fil-A. So maybe he should have. I feel bad saying this because even if someone has an opinion that's opposed to mine, maybe there are times you should keep your mouth shut. If you're a businessman and you want to sell chicken sandwiches, maybe you shouldn't undermine yourself by making incendiary political or religious statements. But that being said, it looks like now there's a counter movement where conservatives are going out of their way to try to support Chick-fil-A. And I think I even saw a picture online of Sarah Palin and her husband holding little white Chick-fil-A paper bags proudly as they left the store or whatever, showing their support for the conservative beliefs of Chick-fil-A's president. But anyway, I'm tired of saying Chick-fil-A. And maybe that will be the drinking game word of the week. Every time I say Chick-fil-A, take a shot. Just kidding. But that's an inside joke for listeners. Whenever I repeat a word too much, I say it should be the basis for a drinking game. So anyway, I'll move on to the topic now of defining atheism. And a couple of things happened this past week that made me want to cover this topic. One was a positive experience. As I've been letting my listeners know, you guys out there, I recently started upping old episodes and new now onto YouTube. So it's basically for now just the audio with some really basic visuals. And at some point I might start recording video podcasts. And I only have a couple of subscribers, and one of them got in touch with me. I don't know if he wants me to read his handle on the air or not. I don't know if that's good or bad. But shall I? He'll probably let me know if it's bad. It's DenverChris78. He's been a subscriber on YouTube since almost the get-go now. And a really cool guy, and he got in touch with me, and he was talking about his view on labels and what, you know, non-believers should perhaps call themselves, or the different definitions. And he talked about how he refers to himself as a agnostic atheist, I believe it was. And I'd never heard that term before, but I like it. And I said back to him that, you know, going by your definition, I think that's what I would be too. And I went on to Wikipedia and actually found that there's an actual entry for agnostic atheist. And according to Wikipedia, agnostic atheism, also called atheistic agnosticism, is a philosophical position that encompasses both atheism and agnosticism. agnostic atheists are atheists because they do not hold a belief in the existence of any deity, and agnostic because they claim that the existence of a deity is either unknowable in principle or currently unknown in fact. The agnostic atheist may be contrasted with the agnostic theist, who does not believe that one or more deities, who does believe that one or more deities exist, but claims that the existence or non-existence of such is unknown or cannot be known. And I want to thank DenverChris78 for bringing this term to my attention, because it exactly sums up my worldview. I'm an atheist because I doubt the existence of a God, but there's also an agnostic element to my belief because I'm not so arrogant as to claim I know for sure there isn't. And this is part of a Wikipedia series on irreligion, and it gets really confusing because if you go to agnosticism, there's strong agnosticism, weak agnosticism. As we already talked about, agnostic atheism, agnostic theism, apatheism, agnosticism, and then there's all different forms of atheism too, and it gets so confusing. And I think for the most part, if other quote-unquote atheists are like me, and I've even seen high-profile atheists, people like Dawkins and Harris and Christopher Hitchens, Dan Dennett, wrestle with this. We don't struggle with labels because we don't know what we believe. It's about other people. A lot of the term atheist itself is so loaded. If you tell someone you're an atheist, they think you're kind of this cold monster almost, who doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in the wonder and magic of life, it's kind of like they look at you like you're some undead creature, like they're about to whip out garlic or a crucifix. And then if you try to tell someone, no, I don't claim to know that there isn't a God with 100% certainty, I just doubt the existence of a God, generally speaking, because the evidence doesn't seem to be there, and because religion seems so man-made, and, you know, I doubt the existence of an afterlife, but I don't know 100%. They go, oh, well, you're agnostic then. And you're like, no, I'm somewhat agnostic. And then you have to try to explain the overlap between atheism and agnosticism. And I talked about on the show a few times how Penn Jillette likes to discuss this. And he talks about how T.H. Huxley, who's a proponent of Charles Darwin's, coined the term agnostic. And supposedly it was a way of offering a more palatable alternative to the term atheist. Penn Jillette likes to call it a weasel word because, in a sense, there is an overlap between the terms atheist and agnostic. A sensible atheist and an agnostic, neither one will say they know for certain that there isn't a God, but you could say they both have their doubts. The agnostic isn't sure if there's a God, and atheist doubts there's a God, so you can see the overlap there. But when you're talking to laymen, and I ran into this recently. I was at a party this past weekend, and I've been this way since I was a kid, where I'm always one of those people in the wee hours of the morning after everyone else has passed out or gone to sleep, I'm still alive and kicking, and I don't want the party to end, and I want to keep on talking to people. And there's always that sad moment where the sun's starting to come up, everyone's disappearing, there's maybe you and one or two other people, and you can tell they're having trouble staying awake. But maybe, you know, you've been talking about some philosophical things. I was talking to this one girl, I obviously won't name her, but she was talking about how she hadn't been raised with religion, and now she thinks that there is a God or must be a God. And when I had mentioned how I'm essentially an atheist or have kind of an atheistic worldview, she all got kind of animated and hot and bothered. And from that point on, whenever I try to explain myself, would basically step on my sentences, wouldn't let me finish, And I was trying to be as composed and as reasonable as possible. And I said that, and she basically pulled out that old saw that, you know, it takes as much faith to be an atheist as it does to be a religious person. And I went on to talk about how any sensible atheist, any atheist I've met, anyone I've listened to, even the most brilliant ones, scientists, people like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, they will readily admit that they can't prove 100% whether or not there's a God. They just doubt God's existence. And she went on to say how atheists are stupid and they claim to know that there's no God. And I said, well, if you met an atheist who says they know 100% that there's no God, then they're stupid. And she jumped on that like red meat. Yeah, atheists are stupid, blah, blah, blah. And when I tried to get into infinite regress, she had no interest in hearing about it. And I even tried to concede that both scientists and religious people have a problem with infinite regress. Let's say if you try to use a theory of everything, if you try to use string theory or Lawrence Krauss's theory about quantum fluctuations and quote-unquote nothingness that allow for the Big Bang and supposedly explain how something can come from nothing, you still even there have a problem with infinite regress. And if you're a religious person, you try to say, well, there must be a God, something can't come from nothing, well, you run into infinite regress. Where did God come from? And of course, they'll say, well, my book says God always was. Okay, you just gotta go buy your man-made book. That's it. But, and I, one of the things I told myself that kind of pride myself on from the get-go of this podcast, I wasn't gonna be a whining non-believer. I wasn't going to talk about feeling like a minority or like a misunderstood atheist. Because I would watch, say, like documentaries, with Richard Dawkins. I'm trying to think if it was The Root of All Evil or another one, but it was one of the BBC documentaries he did where he was meeting in America with a group of atheists, and they were talking about how oppressed they felt, how they're afraid of losing their jobs, this and that. And at the time, I was like, you know, sticking my finger down my throat. I'm like, oh, gag me, bring out the violins. Yeah, in this secular age, you're having trouble being you're an atheist. But it's funny, see, I think I lived in a bubble because I would talk to my bandmates. I would talk to my closest friends who, of course, for the most part, had similar views as me because we tend to gravitate to people who have similar interests and who have a similar worldview to our own. And once I started doing this podcast, like I noticed one interesting experiment is on Facebook. You know, I create a page for the podcast. And there it is, you know, the Week in Doubt. It has the black cross with a question mark. It wasn't my intent to try to insult people with a black cross. It was actually just a design choice. I had gone with a primarily, like, purple color theme, and I thought the black went well with it. But it's something I've been rethinking. I might rebrand the podcast at some point. Maybe I'm being too paranoid or sensitive. I don't know. But I made a Facebook page for the podcast, and I also made a Facebook page for my graphic design company. And I noticed that twice the number of people, friends on Facebook, were willing to like my graphic design page as they were my page on atheism, my page on promoting my atheist podcast. And I always go out of my way to try to handle people with kid gloves and emphasize the point that I'm not trying to insult religious people, and that there's even a lot of things about religion I love, but I think I'm just starting to realize how people really are kind of spooked by the word atheist. It has a very dark and kind of off-putting connotation, and I know I've seen, as I said, prominent atheists discuss whether it's good to refer themselves as atheists, whether they should try to promote other titles. And Christopher Hitchens used to talk about how Dawkins and Dennett used to promote the idea that atheists should refer to themselves as bright are as bright because it has kind of a more friendly or positive connotation. And Hitchens would talk about how cringe-inducing that was, and I wholeheartedly agree with him. And then, you know, there's the idea of Bertrand Russell, and I talked about this on another recent episode, had the idea of the cosmic teapot or celestial teapot, how if we could say, just kind of pull it out of you-know-where and say that there's a teapot revolving around the sun, and we wouldn't be able to see it from Earth, you know? So you'd have to have faith that the teapot was there, and most people would logically and sensibly, even though they couldn't prove it 100%, would assume the teapot doesn't exist because it seems a ludicrous notion that there's a teapot revolving around the sun. And I think Bertrand Russell said that, but you didn't need a special term. You didn't have to refer to yourself as an a teapotist. Or I think like Hitchens or Dawkins would talk about, since you don't believe in the tooth fairy, you don't need to call yourself an a tooth fairyist. It's just you're using common sense and reason to say why you doubt something's existence. It's not a religion in itself. Why do you need a word for that? But it's very frustrating because, like, if you're at a party or something like that and, you know, you're not trying to proselytize, maybe just get into the area of philosophy or religion, or maybe you just want to tell someone you have a podcast and they want to know what it's about. There's this fear. Oh, do I tell them I'm an atheist? That term's so loaded. And then is it accurate? I mean, if I call myself an agnostic atheist, are they going to understand? So it is troubling. I'm just starting to see for the first time how troubling it is to try to find a palatable and accurate way to label your beliefs, to try to convey to other people what you, what your worldview is all about. Maybe it's better not to use any labels at all and just say, I doubt the existence of a creator. Maybe there is. I think religions are man-made. But that'd make it a little hard to label a podcast. I kind of doubt the existence of a creator, but maybe there is podcast. It could be very frustrating. So if there's any fellow non-believers out there listening to this who know what I'm talking about, I definitely feel your pain. And then there's the other term, which I kind of like, humanist. Sometimes you hear the term secular humanist. It's basically just a word for someone that, they may not believe in God, but they believe in ethics. They believe in valuing human life, and they believe in social causes and trying to make the world a better place. So I like secular humanists too. Then if you call yourself that, most people probably have no clue. But I suppose that is a conundrum I'll have to wrestle with. And don't worry, for now, it'll stay the Week in Doubt, a podcast for atheists, agnostics, and whoever. And I wish people... this is probably the first time I've ever really complained on the show, but I wish people would really embrace the whoever more and realize that I'm not trying to rip their beliefs away. This is just a podcast for people to dwell on these things rationally. So we'll see what happens. Maybe sometime down the road, I'll change the artwork for the podcast, and maybe that'll make it a tad more palatable for people. We'll see what happens. But we are now on iTunes. We are on iTunes. We're on iTunes. We're on podbean.com. And we're on YouTube. And there I am again using the Royal We when it's just me and my Mac. But we are on YouTube now. And so if you want to support the show, there I did again, We. Go on YouTube. And if you have a YouTube account, I believe you can also sign in with your Gmail account. Just simply subscribe to the Week in Doubt. And what will that do? It'll make me feel good, definitely. Other than that, I don't know. Maybe it'll up my ranking on YouTube, I believe. So, and I know, not saying this bragging, because by internet standards, this is still relatively small. But when I check my analytics on Podbean, which shows you the numbers for every 30-day period, I usually have somewhere in between maybe 1,100 and 1,600 hits or whatever. So there's someone out there listening. So if you want to be a stand-up guy or girl, look for The Week in Doubt on YouTube and just subscribe. It's absolutely free. And as always, you can write a review or simply click and give a star rating on iTunes. Or if you want to get in touch, I believe there's a mail system on Podbean. If you look for The Week in Doubt on podbean.com, P-O-D-B-E-A-N, .com, you can get in touch with me that way. Or you can even leave a comment on one of the YouTube videos. I'd also like to quickly thank my friends Morgan and Wally. Wally, one of the guitarists in my band, even though we haven't jammed in a while. They're always supporting me by giving me likes on Facebook and things like that whenever I add links for the show. So I just want to, my hat's off to them for that. And once again, Denver Chris 78, thank you for being one of the first subscribers. And thank you for being such a cool, sensible dude. And all right, I will see you guys next week. This has been The Week in Doubt.